So tell me where the movie is now in terms of getting a distributor.
Well, I'm in an interesting thing, which is, there's a schizophrenia to my life right now, which is in one ear, I talk to distributors about the imperatives that distributors think about and want to pursue with a movie like mine, which starts with, a lot of people give me, from a distribution perspective, I think people look at it the way they look at documentaries, which starts with, is this an Academy film? Once Upon a Time with Why We Fight, a lot of distributors looked at that as an Academy-friendly film, and it was ineligible for consideration. So these days, in one year, I have distributors who want to look at my film the way they look at sort of prestige docs that carve out a very heavy and sort of serious view at a look at a situation. And in my and that is that's a double-edged sword, because I have found historically that, and they talk about the sort of Sundance kiss of death in a certain way. And the kiss of death, if it exists for somebody like me, is that people look at your film like a very prestigious object. And that's almost the most dangerous thing you can hear. Like, your film is very important, is dangerous in the sense that, what do I think I'm making? I think I'm making something that's meant to reach as many Americans as I possibly can about
I
something.
sense that from the film itself. Well, why can't you, and you, wait, do you feel an imperative to do that sooner rather than later?
I feel an imperative to do that in the following way. In my left ear, I've got the distributors. In my right ear, I have the grassroots community. And 6 years ago, when I did Why We Fight, I had a conversation with Ralph Nader shortly after the festival. And I said, "How do you think I'm doing?" And he said, "Well, I saw the film. It's great." And I said, "And?" And he said, "Well, I think you're making great movies, but I don't think you're deploying them very well." And he used this verb, deploy. And it has
Which is a
seared.
word often used for armies.
Yeah, and he meant it advisedly, and he meant you have a tool on your hands, and I fear, Nader was thinking, I think, and I fear you think it's an end in itself, when in fact what it is the beginning of a conversation which you now need to pursue across the country. And that conversation is one that is going to be a full-time job for you. And I hadn't expected that. So the one thing was, I got caught by surprise when I made Why We Fight, to discover the only way this thing is going to have the social impact you hope it'll have by promoting dialogue and the rest is if you make a life's work of getting out there with it. And I did a lot of that, and I got to show it at West Point and at military academies and military installations around the world and around the country. And suddenly I was crossing over in a way that was very inspiring for me, very new and different for how docs, which are so commonly looked at as sort of the province of, urban dwelling, coastal, progressive people. Suddenly I was showing my films in multiplexes, because Sony had put it out in a very wide and very mom and pop kind of way, and then sort of mainstream America, Main Street, I guess they
So
say. And at the same
who
time,
released that film?
Why We Fight was Sony Classics.
And did you think
And
they did a good job?
I thought they did a very good job. I mean, the world has changed since then, so I think the way that they did a good job, and this is sort of what I was going to mention, is a little bit less the going rate now than the way I now look at the world.
You're looking
Because
at
in those,
social media more?
I'm looking at what's in my right ear, which is the most exciting call that came after Sundance. And I got a call from every distributor in the world. But the most exciting call was not a distributor, it was Stanford Law School. And
Wow.
Stanford Law School said, "We are going up against the three strikes law in California this year. And we think, because the voters put the law on the books, that they can get rid of it." And the problem with the law is that, thanks to the three strikes law in California, there are 5,000 people sitting in jail in California for life sentences for petty third offenses.
Right.
So you nonviolent third offenses, i.e.
Right.
offenses that none of us would think of as the stuff of a life sentence.
Right.
And they said, "We want to deploy," it was a great use of the word again, "we want to deploy your film to move that needle legislatively so that in November, when this thing comes up on a ballot, your film has gotten people to feel the pathos, that is, the stakes that are involved in this issue. And we can then harness the feelings of that and the social consciousness of that to say to the viewer, you can indeed push a very specific button when you leave the theater. This movie gives you a deep understanding, deep overview of a larger problem. And very often you get one of those with Inconvenient Truth, or you get one of those with varying subjects, Why We Fight, Enron, whatever. But very often it's hard to know, what can I do now other than send money to save the dolphin and hope for that is well targeted. But in this case, one of the things we have this, we've raised a lot of money for the film before we even have a distributor. I've raised, honestly, in the neighborhood of $700,000, $800,000.
And how did you do that?
Well, I raise it because I am finding that in the era of a disillusioned public, i.e. disillusioned with Washington, particularly with Obama, but as they should be, especially with Congress, people who on the streets were protesting have gone quieter than they need to be. In other words, the people who buoyed Obama to victory have been confused by his sort of rather mainstream way of being a president, as distinct from his candidacy. So they are waking up, as you see in Occupy and in other ways, waking up to need to be active. But the philanthropic community got active quite quickly. And so I find that from the Ford Foundation, the River Styx Foundation, and others, we have had a tremendous amount of support for deployment, for getting the movie to be able to address itself to what Orlando Bagwell at Ford calls low-hanging fruit. Like, okay, you have a big movie with a big theme and a big view on the country and a poignant set of people who really moved Eugene's heart, and then Eugene tries to share those people with the public. Well, now what? And that concept is, well, you can take that big movie and you can deploy it at a very local level so that what is for Stanford overturning the three strikes law would be in New York going up against the stop and frisk practices of the NYPD.
I get you. This is fascinating. What this requires is an enormous apparatus to, like it's almost like a political campaign where you're going to take each individual local. I could see it now. You could do a road show. You could go to each individual city with an individual campaign for each market. But you need somebody to back you in that endeavor.
What is the deal with
participant here?
Well, I haven't, to be honest with you, participant of all the conversations has been the quietest. I hate to say that.
Ricky's gone and they're in transition.
Yeah, I really don't know what it is, but I have not yet. I know there's been a little bit of conversation between Sloss and participant, but that isn't among the most active we've had. But I will say this, in this schizophrenia, which is to say, it's unfair to call it a schizophrenia. 6 years ago, the people who were in my right ear as grassroots people seemed to be woefully in another universe from the people in my left ear, which were Sony and the other competitors for the film at that time. Today, and I was seeking at that time rather conventional values. Get me a big advance. Show me you're a big company who's really serious.
That's not what it's about now.
And I'm not into that
now,
frankly.
But if you've raised, you fascinate me. How did you raise $800,000? What did you do, Kickstarter? I mean, what did you do?
No, I mean, this is really just direct outreach on our part toward foundations, but I wish I could take credit for it. Part of it is there is a zeitgeist spirit surrounding this issue. This issue is huge.
It is huge. That's why it blew my mind. I knew vaguely some of this stuff. What you did was to blow the roof off of it and make it all, it's like you saw something very fuzzy and you put it into crystal clear focus so that we could see what it really was and how much it was ruining our country.
And by the way, outside of us guys doing what we're doing, when I say there's a zeitgeist around it, if I didn't exist, this issue is on fire without me. California is having to release 30,000 people. Stanford Law School has the signatures they need to now put a repeal of the three strikes law, the most cherished law in America for drug war hawks and for criminal justice hawks, to put that on the books where it's likely the California voter will vote to amend or repeal it. New York City is under incredible scrutiny now about its stop and frisk. And this is just the beginning. As Charles Ogletree said in the film, we've never had so many people on the same side of this issue. Bratton, who is arguably not just the leading law enforcement person in New York and California, he's America's sheriff, basically. He's against it.
I agree with you. I think people on every from every persuasion, including me, really admire
him. I don't know if you saw this. Did you see that in The Atlantic, there was an article about a week and a half ago that said, and you'll love this one, and if you don't have it, I'll email it to you because it's mind-blowing. Like, basically, it's an article that says, yes, it's all true. We're the world's biggest jailer. It's tragic. All of the stuff in Eugene's movie is true and horrible. But interestingly, don't fall for the hype. The prison industry went through the same housing bubble that the housing industry went through. So there are towns all over this country. While we are the world's biggest jailer, we are massively overbuilt with prisons. So towns that thought they were going to have the lifeblood of a prison on their hands are dying out and becoming ghost town, doomed towns, because they bet it all on the local prison. They forewent other industries, closed up shop in other ways, and now there are no prisoners to fill those beds.
Oh, that's interesting. Very interesting. So that's a good story. Would you ever add that to your movie? How closed and final and completely shut down is your movie?
I'm still working on my movie because one of the things, I always think about Paul Revere. Like when Paul Revere warned the Americans, about the British, he chose four words. He didn't say, the British look like there might be planning an invasion.
The British are coming.
Yeah, because it fit the urgency. And my movie, I believe, is too long by some minutes.
Oh.
And it's too long, literally, in trying to cover the waterfront. I feel that the movie asks the viewer for too long a lease on their evening.
Well, you are being hard on yourself. I would profoundly disagree with you, but that's, cutting can never hurt. As long as you don't take something out that,
I won't take anything, dear. And I'm very careful about that kind of stuff, but I generally want the viewer, there is a level of animation that the viewer can get to in a movie if it's correctly designed, and I don't want to waste that. I want the viewer at the height of their animus to have the movie end, and they go out and argue with their friends about it and go push various buttons that they need to push as people to help make change. And if you wear them down with the gravity of it too much, there's a line, and I just want to find that line. So we're still working on it, but when you ask, will something like, let me go back to this grassroots thing, because it'll answer a little bit of what my MO is. My MO is that I had the option at the end of the movie to endorse any number of ways that you solve the problem of the drug war, because there are many out there. And I opted to not do that because it felt to me like whatever opinion I have, and, I'm hoping to grow up one day, and in my current state of evolution, whatever I've signed on to in my heart, and I have a very clear idea of what I think should happen to the drug war, but I thought that putting it in the end of the movie muscled out what I really want, which is everybody to have their own view, and most of all, to get engaged on this and to push the kind of button they're comfortable pushing.
You should know that I came out of a supermarket the other day, and some geezer with a pad was, come sign this thing. The thing you tune out, the thing you never listen to, and it was about the three strikes law. And I, ran over there and signed this thing.
That's fantastic. What you signed, are you in California?
Yeah.
That's from Stanford. That is the program that they're going to be using my film for.
I signed it.
It's great. More power to you.
This would argue, though, for you to, honestly, Eugene, I'm going to write that I think this movie will probably win the Oscar next year. So, that's how I feel.
I can tell you that what's been inspiring, and a little bit is stuff that's sensitive that I don't totally want to divulge it because I don't want to imperil the conversation.
Well, Sloss's own operation isn't bad. You couldn't do badly with him.
With what?
Sloss's own operation isn't bad.
Yeah, I know. And, here's what it looks like to me is this. I spoke to Michael Barker at the end of the screening.
Well,
in
I was going to say, they would seem a natural partner here.
Yes, and they've been a partner in the previous On Why We Fight, and I felt very excited about that. And that dialogue is ongoing. At the same time, and that is a model, but it's a model that says, we are a big, badass, huge organization, and we can give you reach on a subject like this and gravitas on a subject like this that's kind of worthy of the movie. I know that Michael seems to like it. Michael loved it, and Tony would win the Oscar. Tom either played bad cop on that or truly was less bullish.
Let me ask you another question, backing up. Yeah. If you've raised all this what I have to consider what it's called is P&A money, correct?
It's not P&A money.
What is it?
Because I can't use philanthropic money for P&A. This money is to have a staff of people who design for me a massive grassroots, digital, social media, but concrete on the ground campaign. You know the thing you said earlier would take an incredible amount of work? It's that process that's being funded. That
okay.
Basically finding the low-hanging fruit, finding partner organizations, setting up events. It's sort of in the red state model that Kevin Smith did, where in each individual place you're really doing a serious event.
This
and you're
is the future.
That day and
this
day.
Is the future for this kind of movie.
I think so, too.
Yeah,
I think so,
absolutely.
Too. And without being crass, what Tom and Michael did in a weird way by playing a little bit of a game after Sundance was they let me go wander.
Mm-hmm.
And when I went and wandered, mm-hmm. I found very interesting ways of doing this
mm-hmm.
that I think are more are honestly sexier and better for a movie like this than the old security blanket I felt when the big company came around.
Mm-hmm.
So it gave me a moment where I actually went and sort of I saw Paris, and it's hard to bring me back to the farm. Like I've now had a brush with. Oh, that's how this could work. So the schizophrenia, where I used to have to hide my grassroots light under a bushel because they don't really do that stuff, and they were... Sonny was unimaginative when
well,
I dealt with them.
I would give them a chance because I think that I have seen... what I'm trying to say is that I have seen Tom be remarkably innovative in certain doc situations.
Good.
The one that I'm thinking of specifically was a bird doc. I can't remember the name of it right now. Winged migration. Right.
Winged migration.
Yeah. And there are a couple times where I've seen them go way off the farm and really get excited and engaged. Right now, you know, they're like obsessed with the Oscars and they're kind of, you know, freaked out and exhausted, and they've been to Berlin and they've been mourning, you know, Bingham Rae and, you know, everything else that's been going on. You are perfectly entitled to believe that you should be the center of the universe, but they have other fish to fry right now. They will come back to you, and I will bet you that if you give Tom a chance, he will figure out all kinds of exciting things. But I'm not defending them per se. I'm excited by what you're talking about.
I mean, these are all ways of doing it, and the thing that is the expected part is that I have a long love affair with both of them, and, you know, one imagines that somewhere between playing a game and being smart businessmen, I'm in some loop with them. What? And I expected that, and that's no surprise. And I love them, and I don't mind if that's who
they
are.
So let me know. I mean, so is there another, you know, participant being quiet? I mean, that's what they do. But it sounds like you've already started to organize something that's the equivalent of what they do anyway.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's no question that conversation is ongoing between Sloss and them, but I found it in the context of the festival. It was only after the festival that conversation with participants started to pick up. Some of the most interesting conversations have come from not just, you know, basically from people who are a lot more cognizant, honestly, even than both of the companies we've talked to, about how to do everything that includes day and date, everything that does a specialty movie like mine that can get taken out. Yes, it can get taken out in a lot of markets, but you can really do, you know, 10 or 12 very key markets where you muscle up and you take the film and deploy it in conjunction with a lot of other power. And I think the power that my funding has brought at the grassroots level probably is a model for how movies can be doing this more. And I see it. I've seen it with a couple of movies before me, and I just feel lucky that we have it. What it's letting me do is basically not be so schizophrenic. I now want to find a distribution deal that that understands the power of that grassroots infrastructure. I've got 70 or 80 partner organizations that have already reached out to us, or I've reached out to. Ever since the festival, separate from that, I've had 600 emails since the end of January, since the end of the festival. It's 2 weeks, which is 600 emails. What is that per day, right? I get
That's
40
incredible.
Emails a day.
That's amazing.
And those emails all say, hi, I'm at Chicago Law School. We want to show your film.
Mm-hmm.
I'm at Loyola.
Mm-hmm.
I'm at Miami State. Mm-hmm. I'm at Michigan. And those, I never had that, and I didn't have it with Why We Fight. And what it tells me is that people in the criminal justice world know that at a time where the country is hemorrhaging economically the way that we are, a gigantic disaster and a disastrous economic wave, something that is morally bankrupt and economically bankrupt and practically bankrupt, is ripe for change in a way that they can all taste like they could taste victory a short way down the pike. And it's small victories that are looked for, and that's low-hanging fruit. And so suddenly I have this massive architecture around the country of people who can actually take my movie and make a dent with it. Whereas with a lot of movies, there's not that much you can do with them. With Why We Fight, what was the public going to do? Go chain their arms around a military base or block the entrance to Lockheed? These are very limited options because they can't touch the military budget. Well, in the criminal justice world, there are pieces of legislation all over the place. And frankly, there is the basic chemistry of politicians who play the tough on crime card.
I know.
And in doing so, deeply damage the country.
That's
and if
right.
you give Americans a tin ear to that, I believe, you know, once upon a time we dragged women by their hair as a people. We don't do that anymore. We thought the world was flat, and it's not flat. There are things we pass through as a people. And I think that mass incarceration in the United States, in the way that we do it, is being humiliated every single day.
Where did you find that guy, the one who made the parallel, the academic who made the parallel to the Holocaust?
Yeah.
Where did you find that? That like blew my mind.
Yeah, it blew mine too. And it, and as a as a Jewish person, it resonated a lot. And I first read a book by him called Drug Warriors and Their Prey. And at that time, I did not know that he looked like an Amish person. And I did not know that he talked like an encyclopedia. I just thought, what a great book. So I show up in Kansas City, Missouri, where he is really a classic historian who you feel like almost never leaves the library.
Right.
Certainly, you don't feel like he's ever been in the major metropolitan center outside of Kansas City. He feels rural. He feels like old American rural sort of Quaker value.
Right.
And but his book doesn't read like that. His book reads like it's written by a extremely savvy urban cultural critic and historian. And so I was very shocked to find him, and I was then deeply struck that here what I'm listening to is really a person whose perspective on the country goes back to Lincoln primarily, because that's an area of focus of his. But he's also been a student of the legal systems of a lot of countries, including Nazi Germany, and he looks at the development and the misdevelopment of law in different societies and the way it can run amok. And
that's what happened here. Yep.
Yeah, and what it's a part of, is I look at my movie.
Although
right now,
I appreciated the degree, and this must have been something you were very sensitive to, the degree to which you pulled back from going too far with this.
Yes, you have to be.
You have to be.
Because there's nothing worse than a clumsy and misplaced analogy, but there are benefits to analogy if they are surgically handled,
right?
Because they can enlighten. But if they go too far, they add more heat than light,
That's right. Just
inflame people and upset them, and they actually close the very minds they're looking to contribute to. But that's true in every testimony I have. I mean, I have a lot of people. If you sat in my editing room, historically, the stuff that ends up on my cutting room floor is the juiciest stuff that people say to me. And I always end up taking it out of the films because it's usually cheap shot material, which services my, I get a holiday in my heart the first couple of times I hear it. And then three or four times later, I feel, you know what? That's overplayed and it's undermining the credibility and the listenability of the speaker. That person, in a way, I protect them from themselves. So people will say things that are more strident. And my editorial decision is, as part of a chorus, these people, if they were all sitting in a room together, they wouldn't talk in that strident a way. They're in an unfair situation where I'm asking them interview questions. And in the purity of that black limbo that we're in, they're saying a certain thing. When I then put them in chorus, I want the chorus to gingerly bring the audience to a new level of understanding. And somebody who throws a giant sledgehammer can be, not always, but it can be inappropriate. So you'll notice that David Simon, and this is sort of, this is shop talk about the movie, but David Simon says some incredibly powerful things to me that didn't end up in the movie, because when they would have gone in the movie, they were too much too soon for him to ultimately talk at the end of the movie about why don't we just kill the poor. The guy who says kill the poor at the end of the movie and has been a reserved communicator all the way along is a true reflection of Simon. If all I do is take his juiciest bits and I pepper them across the movie, he will come across without the reserve he showed me when we spoke.
He was extraordinary. He was. I wasn't at all surprised, as a big a fan of his and The Wire, as I've been. But he was extraordinary. I have to say, he was
and
a great spokesperson for you.
Right. And you know what I mean? Like, if he, I did a 3-hour interview with him, right? So
right.
out of that 3-hour interview, there's X minutes in the movie. If I make them all strident, I actually color the way you perceive him as a communicator in an unfair way. He comes across like a guy who keeps playing drum solos rather than a responsible drummer who keeps the beat, and every now and then he does a little flourish. Well, that's how most good communicators speak, and I have to do a lot of that in the movies, and Richard Miller was reserved in that way, as you said, and I reserved others for a proper reflection of them and a strategic and decent way of promoting.
Well, the other thing I really appreciated, too, was now that when I'm thinking about you trimming, the physical language of the cops in the car, the sort of beat
yes.
cops, the worn down beat cops who were so cynical,
yep.
said
yeah.
so much of what you
yes,
wanted to say.
Too.
It didn't matter what they said as much as they're just their demeanor, their mean.
And they're deeply likable.
Yeah.
Like, what I find about all these people is, you know, they used to talk about Hannah Arendt, you talk about the banality of evil. And that isn't our system. Our system, it's not banality you find. It's actually weirder than that. Americans, if you talk to them, if you don't talk to people in a substantive way, they'll all talk about baseball and, you know, and who's gotten, you know, plastic surgery or who's divorcing. They live at that level because that's the kind of circus that we're fed as a society. And we feed addictions in this society. Everything is quick fix stuff. So you'll get a lot of that. But if you scratch the surface with most people, and I found it across the system of mass incarceration we have, you find very real people. And then you're in a really strange thing, which is they understand that there's something fundamentally wrong about a system constructed upon the need for a steady flow of human beings as fuel. They understand that in their own way. And they will even talk philosophically about their own regrets, their own reservations, but they all have a complex understanding of how the way they do their job ideally makes the most of a bad situation. So that the jailer will tell you, I don't agree with the laws, they're too strict, the politicians run on them because that's the kind of cheap currency they use to get elected. So they fill my prison with bodies. And then lo and behold, when they want their tough on crime law to give us, you know, taller fences and, you know, tougher handcuffs and longer overtime for cops, where does the money come from? It comes out of the very programs here I need at my prison to reduce recidivism. Jailer after jailer told me this. So now you have really smart people on the inside. And I say, well, what do you try to do? He says, I try to make these programs as good as they can be, because most of the people who come in here have never had a job. Nobody ever gave them a chance. Nobody ever taught them a skill. And if I can do one thing that'll reduce the likelihood of seeing them in 2 months again, it's to give them all that. And lo and behold, that's the rug that gets pulled out from under me. That's a level of depth of understanding I, of course, didn't have when I started the film. It was totally eye-opening. And the insiders, the only ones who have. But the same is true of the cops, who will tell you, I'm out here every week and I see the same people over and over again. So,
yeah.
Of course, this isn't working.
Yeah.
But my life depends on it. My job depends on it. But it's not banality of evil. And I actually haven't found a correct fill-in for banality. But in some way, there's a humanity in it. There's a humanism within this evil that is, I don't know if you remember, it's almost scarier. Do you remember, did you ever see The Cooler? Do you remember that movie?
Nah, is that the one with Bill Macy and Alec Baldwin?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. There's one great scene in it where Alec Baldwin summarizes how knocking down Vegas and turning it into Disneyland is pernicious, because in the old days, Vegas was like the nation's liver or kidney. It processed all the toxins. We got all that stuff out of our system. The grown-ups went there and got their vices out. And now, and I remember he talked about this while they were knocking down the old grungy buildings and putting up, you know, what looked like, you know, Epcot Center displays.
Paris.
And he said,
or
now
yeah.
we're basically learning to feed the stuff to our kids in the drinking water.
Ugh, yeah.
You know, we're bringing them into this city of vice. that concept is very analogous to what I've noticed, which is there is a great deal of humanity across the system of mass incarceration. And that is scary in one way because it persists, but it's beautiful in another way because it was those very people that taught me that this system will change. Mm. Because when a guy like that prison guard speaks from uniform with that degree of courage, he will move mountains, and you will not for long be able to see that spirit not emerge.
Some of this stuff is. Did you see the Werner Herzog death penalty movie?
The Abyss. Yeah.
There was some good stuff in there.
Yeah, the fact is, like, I didn't have to be, I didn't have to be special at all to enter the prison system in America with a camera and a microphone, and come away with introspective testimony from people who are deeply critical from the inside. It's a common reality.
So and what's your really timetable inspiring. Now, do you
My
think?
My timetable is between, you know, for example, the California three strikes thing is an electoral matter because it's going to be on the ballot. And so are several other movements around the country. That those are the low-hanging fruit. So basically, between now and the end of the summer, I want the movie to come out theatrically and on several other platforms that will... that will start to shine that light in a very intense way across the late part of the elections.
And you'll be all over it. You'll be all over Bill Maher, and you'll be on the Tonight Show, and you'll do all that good stuff. You know,
And if I'm lucky, Colbert and Stewart and all those people. Did you ever see that he spoofed the Move Your Money piece I did?
No.
I invented the Move Your Money campaign by
right. And by the way, I'm in a low hanging credit union, just so you know.
Good okay. for you.
Go,
good.
Go
I'm
ahead.
Very proud.
Go ahead.
and he brought me on, and instead of I had done this little recut of It's a Wonderful Life that basically said to people, if you love It's a Wonderful Life and yet you love George Bailey, get your money away from Mr. Potter. That was the message. And a lot of people, it resonated, a lot of people, big viral hit. Colbert has me on, and he makes his own video where he cut It's a Wonderful Life the opposite way to show that George Bailey was terrorizing Bedford Falls and the beneficent Mr. Potter was bailing everybody out.
That's great.
So all of George's drunken stuff looked like a madman terrorizing
that's
the
right.
town.
Oh, that's great. That's great.
It was funny. It was very funny. I have the special opportunity, and it's thanks to a couple things. There's a zeitgeist around me that is seething without me doing anything. And so I didn't have that with Why We Fight. When I entered Why We Fight, Tom and Michael, for example, told me when they bought Why We Fight, they were like, we got to wait on this movie because the public's not ready for this movie. Well, that's not true of this movie. This movie, the public is overwhelmingly ready for. I find the response to the film everywhere I go is extremely animated. And that is
because you're explaining it. You're explaining something. It's like, how does it really work? Well, here's how. And something that we never quite understood suddenly makes a lot of sense. That's what you've done. It's extraordinary.
And without me, it's moving along with so much power. And that's why I have this philanthropic money. The philanthropic money has said, hey, we want to change criminal justice. That film is a good horse to bet on to help brand this issue and widen people's thoughts on it. So if it's in the best of all worlds, the film will become a kind of deep branding, a kind of deep look at a subject that lets people have a tremendous amount of context so that the legislative issue that comes before them, they are very versed in the issue. When that smaller thing comes up, they know how to think about it. When a politician works tough on crime rhetoric at them, they'll remember Charles Ogletree saying we have to be smart on crime, not tough on crime. And they'll understand that that whole tough on crime era is a tragic thing of the past. And now the question is, what do we do next and how do we reform this? And everybody has to have their own take on that. And in different areas around the country, there are going to be different leverage points. And that's where I have this great moment where the distribution side can suddenly dovetail with all this grassroots robust activity. And that's a first for me. And it's a hugely exciting opportunity.
No, almost every conversation. Have a blast. This is great.
Almost every distribution conversation we're having, I'm talking about grassroots stuff in a way that I used to hide under a bushel when I talk to distributors who basically, it all sounded like, A, it sounded like distraction, and B, it sounded like it would take seats out of their theater or something. You know, it was like yesterday's way
of
thinking.
But the point is that the world has changed in that regard, and a lot of people are looking at it very... So am I to infer that you are looking at IFC and Magnolia in a different way than you would have 6 years ago?
They're definitely in the dialogue with us in a pretty robust way. But with all of them, I'm finding it more welcome. There are also some much more digital, much more sort of unusual and surprising players. But IFC and Magnolia are definitely in the conversation as well. And to them, concepts like this are actually much more welcome than they used to be. When you have these kind of conversations, they actually see the tremendous added value that the grassroots world
Although I've
can sort of
never, I
impart.
have they. Ha, I'm just curious. Have they engaged in a big way politically on a like paramount almost? I mean, what they did with Inconvenient Truth or they're more sophisticated in a way, I would say, in a funny way, even though they're a studio, because Megan
I think from
Colligan
a
and her
track
people
record,
are good, you know.
I think from a track record, first of all, I'd love to be in a further dialogue with Paramount about it. I know they looked at the film. I don't know what the status of Paramount is, but I do know that, oh, actually, no. I think they have been in some measure of dialogue, but I do know all of that. I am less inspired by everyone's track record than I am by the nature of the conversations I'm having, which are forward-looking, and everybody has caught the bug that there's got to be a better way to do these things, and that they are willing to avail more of those ways than they were in the past.
Cool.
I'm having these conversations, and no one is balking at the muscle that I want to bring. No one's balking at that kind of red state model where you really are sure you're doing a whatever city release, but within a whatever market release, but within that, you're really assertively going after certain markets where the film can identify itself as having scored a successful legislative blow. The first film that starts to really do that is going to be perceived as a social force of a different order of magnitude than all the films, like the many that I've made, that simply do seem to end up on a heap of well-meaning, world-exploring art. And that has its place. But we're also at a time where there's enormous urgency, where I want to say the British are coming fast,
Well,
furiously, and effectively.
but that's why Inconvenient Truth is an interesting, comparison.
Yes.
And participant, of course, was involved with that. Well, this was really fun talking to you.
It was
Very,
really,
very,
really great
really
talking
fun.
to you. And it's an exciting time for me. And there's certainly, I think you writing about this, given who you are, is very helpful. I think it's wonderful. And I think it'll, because I don't get to talk to people a lot about what I'm doing. And I'm sort of bubbling along right now with a huge amount of passion and enthusiasm for how this can look. And it's something that a lot of people should be doing and thinking about with their movie. And honestly, it wasn't a great skill that we raised this money. It's that there is the spirit of Occupy and the spirit of the Tea Party, which is a spirit on different ends of the spectrum that says we no longer have faith in government and corporate America to save us, and we certainly don't believe in people who are leader figures, because they're under too many, even with the best of intentions, they're tangled up in too many knots. The equivalent of that popular spirit is that wealthy people and wealthy institutions are understanding the need to muscle up and raise awareness and back the kind of initiatives that we're looking at here. And that's a whole new thing for me, where I felt much more in the wilderness with why we fight than I feel with this.
Okay, the other question was Obama. What kind of, I mean, wouldn't you want to get this in front of his eyes?
I do, and I do know that David Axelrod has requested the movie, so I do have a sense that they're looking at it, which I think is terrific. Obviously, part of the goal of the movie is to let Obama and company know that the spirit of this, whether it's at Sundance or whether it's as it unfolds across the country, is reflective of rather growing consensus in this country that incarcerating Americans for drug crimes, for often longer sentences than we incarcerate people for rape, robbery, and murder, is totally wacky in the eyes of most Americans. It's inconsistent with both the morality of Americans and with their plain common sense about how they want law enforcement to work. So Obama, who feels a great deal of pressure electorally and otherwise, should know that there are more people in this country who think it's crazy than who think it's correct. And there are also a tremendous number of people in this country who, I believe, would support much farther-reaching legislation to normalize America's treatment of drugs so that it's dealt with as a public health problem, as other Western democracies deal with it, as opposed to a criminal justice opportunity, which is how we see it, with such damaging results.
All right. No, very well said. All right. Thank you very much, Eugene, and best of
luck. I'd love to talk to you
any
more about it. If you have any other questions, as you can tell, it's a subject I love talking about.
You got
it. As difficult a subject as it is, it means a great deal to me.
I can see that. All right. Okay. Thanks a lot. Okay.
Bye-bye. Thank you. Bye now.